And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Been craving some fresh fish lately? You're not the only one, and that's the problem. The demand for fish worldwide and our newfound taste for the fresh catch is having a huge impact on the world's oceans. Is cod okay, or snapper, or maybe shrimp? It's all so confusing. But there's a handy new little pocket guide that will help you find your way to healthy choices for the oceans and you. And you'll find out about all this and more when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Get ready. March is right around the corner. And if the current winds of change are any indication, March will come in like a pride of lions on a hunt. Politics is everywhere, dominating the news. From Port Dubai, the emerging civil war in Iraq, the mullahs of Iran, domestic spying. The only way nature can penetrate into the headlines is when it is devastating, as it was in the Philippines, as a whole village was buried in a massive mudslide. We all heard about that. There was a time when nature was associated with peace and beauty, solace, and the grand American ideals of freedom and individualism. And the sad truth is that nature now is wounded. I wish it wasn't so. As a boy, I was filled with wonder. I never dreamed that this day would come. And I'm not alone. Most everyone I know feels this same sense of loss. We on planet Earth are in tough times. I often question whether I'm being too negative, and I question because I'm a very positive person. But a time has come, an historic time, a turning point, when we need to speak the truth, and that's what we do here on the Wild Side News each week. In many respects, our best hope right now is to change. If everyone on this planet just put consumption on hold for a couple of years, slowed our stampede to every corner of the earth to yank from its hills and mountains, lakes and sacred places, every valuable commodity to bring to the marketplace, well, the only one hurt would be the greedy. But we could do with a lot less greed these days. But it's not going to happen. So it's up to each of us to do our part, to act responsibly and intelligently and cooperatively to reinforce wisdom. Our greatest wisdom right now comes in uniting our common wisdom into a change agent. And it's happening. Today we head north a bit, up the coast to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, the legendary showcase of oceanic creatures. Over the years, the Monterey Bay Aquarium has become fully aware of the changes in the realms of the oceans, and they're expanding their educational mission across the nation to help build awareness that we have the power to change the future of life on Earth, and the power to choose right is our most important freedom, which we can still exercise with wisdom. It's a show about fish and fishing and the food it brings, and how you can turn the tide of the ocean's future. And it may seem a stretch to tie in the debate over domestic spying into a show about nature and the environment, except that from the great American legacy of our national parks grew a firmament to freedom enshrined in our national parks and monuments. They serve as beacons which shine the light of our past onto the uncertainty of our future. And Manzanar is a place that, thank God, lives on to do just that. It's your Voice of the Earth, from the common voices of the people who love the earth, coming up following the news. So now, the news. As leading fundamentalist churches unite to fight global warming, that is, to stop global warming, some animal scientists who study the fundamentals of gorilla behavior are inching ahead and acknowledging that these great apes are actually somewhat intelligent. According to Ingrid Porton, curator of primates at the St. Louis Zoo, these animals are smart enough to observe behaviors and imitate them. Researchers in other primate centers are quietly screaming that bonobos and other primates exhibit extraordinary awareness and can communicate with thoughts, reason, and have complex feelings and awareness. Meanwhile, the forests that make up the gorilla and bonobo homelands are being turned into pulp and timber so that people around the world can read about such findings in the newspaper, which are then thrown away the next day. While on the topic, President George Bush is quickly becoming the alternative energy president as he visited three states to promote using alternative energy sources. Although he did not repeat a promise to cut back on Middle East oil imports that drew complaints from leaders of the OPEC countries and was disavowed by his energy secretary. All the slipping and sliding about oil and its future in America was overshadowed when the president scheduled an appearance at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado, only to discover a few days before the visit that 34 of NREL's employees had been laid off due to cuts in funding. Well, the administration demonstrated its dedication to bringing a positive message to renewable energy by quickly transferring $5 million to the NREL facility, which allowed them to hire back the 34 employees days before the president's appearance to help the president's appearance as a strong advocate and champion of these new renewable energy demonstrations. The president summed up America's challenge to create an alternative to a reliance on Middle East oil imports when he stated, "Some of the nations we rely on for oil have unstable governments or fundamental differences with the United States. These countries know we need their oil, and that reduces influence. It creates a national security issue when we're held hostage for energy by foreign nationals that may not like us." Mr. Bush recently admitted an addiction to oil. The first step to a cure is admitting to being an addict. We're with you, Mr. President. Our addiction to oil is bringing out, as addictions of any sort so often do, unsocial behaviors and unreasoned reactions. This week, the Senate held hearings on the bill introduced by Pete Domenici of New Mexico, which would open up nearly 4 million acres to offshore oil and gas development and allow state governors to petition the Interior Department for waivers of current coastal leasing bans for natural gas development, allow oil production if the state agrees to it, and coerce coastal states to accept more offshore drilling and drilling closer to shore. Addiction. Fight the disease. Just say no. Paul Watson, who was featured in a live satellite hookup here on the Wild Side News while he was chasing a Japanese whaling ship from the frigid waters of the Southern Oceans in his ship the Farley Moat, is currently stuck in South Africa with his crew as the Farley Moat sits chained under police guard in Cape Town Harbor. The ship is being detained by South African marine officials who say it does not meet safety requirements. Labeled a pirate and an ecological terrorist by critics, Captain Watson says he is upholding international laws which are set up to protect whales from illegal hunting. "Nobody would walk by a kitten or a dog being kicked to death. Nobody would walk by a child being abused or a woman being raped and beaten," he says. "I don't see how anybody can stand there and watch when a whale is harpooned and dies an agonizing death without intervention." In California, doctors refuse to participate in an execution of a convicted rapist and murderer of a 17-year-old girl, claiming that improper administration of the three-drug sequence, if not administered properly, could cause pain and suffering. All the while in Greenland, glaciers are dumping more than twice as much water into the Atlantic Ocean now as 10 years ago. Over the last 20 years, the air temperature in southern Greenland has risen by 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Some researchers are predicting that the original estimate of a rise in ocean waters of 1 foot in the next 100 years could actually be 3 feet in 100 years. That's 1 foot in the next 33 years, which is a half foot in 16.5 years, and that's 6 inches in 8.25 years, 3 inches in just over 4 years, and over an inch in the next year. And here comes March, just around the corner. Get ready for another wild ride as things keep warming up on good old planet Earth. And that's the news. And now a few reminders. Next week, we go in-depth as we focus in on global warming with some of the leading experts in the field who will be participating in the Wallace Stegner Symposium on Global Warming. If you want to hear from the world's best voices of the Earth and be informed and make choices that matter for the future of life on Earth, tune in each week to your Voice of the Earth, the Wild Side News. And speaking of making wise choices... Well, here in the end of February 2006, the oceans just keep on moving to the forefront in the news all the time. Already people are beginning to talk about getting ready for the upcoming hurricane season. We're hearing stories of the Greenland ice sheet melting much faster than anyone had anticipated. And, of course, there's always the ongoing saga of what is absolutely happening to the oceans. And it's a bit tragic. So a lot of people are really beginning to step up to the plate and try to take control of our future and hopefully do something to reverse the trend, which is leading to the demise of so many creatures in the wild places, and that includes the oceans. And joining us now from the Monterey Bay Aquarium is Ken Peterson. Ken, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
First of all, let's talk about the Monterey Bay Aquarium. It's a legendary place. Give us a sense of what you guys are up to these days.
Well, the aquarium started out in 1984 with the idea of being a window into the marine life of California's Central Coast. We had a great location on Cannery Row, a historic cannery building that was completely rebuilt into a beautiful contemporary aquarium. And our original exhibits focused on our local and regional marine life. We were able, because the bay is a relatively pristine body of water, to pump 2,000 gallons a minute, water directly from the bay into the exhibits and send it right back into the bay. And so it really becomes a living extension of what's out in the bay itself. And we've grown from there in the two-plus decades since then to incorporate exhibits of open sea life a little farther off the coast of California, to develop a special exhibition program that brings in notable marine life from around the world so we can tell interesting and engaging stories to visitors, and also bring some conservation stories to people that might not be as obvious in the marine life of California waters. Also, over time, and as you mentioned at the top of the program, we have become more aware of the threats facing marine life. They have grown in scope, and the pace of the change affecting the oceans is increasing over time. And we realized that we could not just inspire people and wow them with beautiful exhibits that they'd never seen before, but we really had a responsibility to use the information that we had, share that with our public, and we hope motivate them to become stewards of the ocean in a variety of different ways.
This is open to the public. It's 7 days a week.
So the only day we're closed is Christmas Day, and it's 10 to 6 every other day. Summers and holidays, you get an extra half hour in the morning at 9:30. We're opening up.
And then as well, give us your website.
MontereyBayAquarium.org. And, in fact, people who log on to the website can look at 7 streaming webcams, one that points right out onto the surface of Monterey Bay, so you always know what the weather's like and whether the harbor seals and cormorants are on the rocks off our oceanfront decks. We have exhibits in our sea otters, cameras in our sea otters and kelp forest exhibits in our million-gallon Outer Bay exhibits, so you can check out the bluefin and yellowfin tuna, and if we ever get another young white shark, you'd be able to watch the shark there. So a lot of ways of kind of experiencing what's here, planning a trip, and a lot of educational activities for kids, for families, school groups, teachers, and scientists as well, and a growing section of conservation information, including ways that people can get active in becoming advocates for and stewards of the oceans.
How long have you been with the aquarium?
I actually started volunteering here as a volunteer guide back when the aquarium opened in 1984.
Wow.
And then went through a little career change a few years later and have been on staff since 1989.
I'm glad I asked, because people have always been fascinated by the oceans. There's every reason to. But what's the trend line here? What's happening with your visiting public and how their experience is perhaps changing?
Well, I think more people are looking at the oceans and have a bit of the ocean on the radar. For the longest time, it's out of sight, out of mind, the sense that the oceans are so vast and so alien, really, that first they're so big we can't affect them, and so alien because we don't really visit them the way we do places on land, that there was no sense of what is happening, what is going on to the health of ocean wildlife and ecosystems. As our awareness of the world at large has grown, as scientists have been able to do more investigating and looking at and bringing their images back, we have a much better sense of what's happening with the oceans, and a lot of it is not good. You're absolutely right. There are scientific studies in the last few years that indicate that 90% of the large ocean predators, the big tunas, the swordfish, the marlins, the large sharks, are gone. And they didn't just vanish. They were fished out because our fisheries management policies are not keeping pace with the technologies we have for extracting wildlife from the oceans. It's been called the last buffalo hunt by Carl Safina of the Blue Ocean Institute, and that's exactly what it is in many ways. Our hope is that as you raise people's awareness of these issues, not in a defeatist way, but in a way that gives them some sense of hope and empowers them to make a difference, that we can collectively protect ocean wildlife, ocean ecosystems, and restore the ones that have been so badly damaged by mismanagement over the years.
It's that effort of the Monterey Bay Aquarium that is bringing me to talk with you right now. I was going through my current edition of Mother Jones News, which brings the information that we oftentimes don't find and brings it in depth in ways that we oftentimes don't see as well. And included in the back of this was a little tear-out piece, a little fold-up pamphlet that fits handily into your wallet or purse or whatever, or pocket. And it's beautifully done. It's called the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch National Seafood Guide. What is this about?
We have been working since 1997, really, to change the way public views seafood and to use the power that we all have as consumers to transform the market for seafood in ways that supports sustainable wild fisheries and responsible, sustainable fish farming or aquaculture. The Seafood Watch program is the result of that effort, and it's grown and strengthened over the years. We have, over the course of the last 7 years, distributed, now it's close to 8 million of those pocket guides.
Fabulous.
Not just a national guide, which is generically good for the whole country, but regional guides that we've developed for every major region of the U.S., the West Coast, the Northeast, the Southeast, and Gulf Coast, the Midwest region of the country, Hawaii. We have guides in Spanish, both a national guide and a West Coast regional guide. We use a team of biologists and fisheries researchers to study the best and most current fisheries management data from national and international sources. We consult with commercial fishermen on what's going out in the water. We build sets of scientific reports that look at the health of all the species that are included on those lists, whether it is the accidental catch and kill of other species that when you're trying to get the particular one you want to bring to market, whether it's the impact that fishing gear has on the habitats that these animals depend upon and that other animals depend upon for their survival, with aquaculture, whether or not it's being done in a sustainable way or whether it's being done in ways that are exacerbating problems for other ocean wildlife. And we sort all of those recommendations by a set of criteria that we think contributed to healthy oceans over the long term and healthy ocean fisheries. And we rank all of the seafood as either a green list best choice, a yellow list good alternative, kind of the caution light. There may be some issues and problems there. And a red list of avoid species. And if you look at the pocket guide that you have in front of you, you'll see that the red list is fairly short. The best choices and the good alternatives list are fairly long. And I think a big part of the Seafood Watch message is there's a lot of good seafood out there. There are a lot of good choices you can make and substitutions you can make. And your power as a consumer can have a big impact on how the business of producing fish for human consumption is run.
Now, there's a number of criteria that you've used to make these selections, and briefly, and this is covered wonderfully, elegantly in the guide, these are the concerns that you look at. One is, where is the seafood from? Two, is it farmed or wild caught? And then three, how was it caught? And so these factor into the selections, and then, of course, there's other issues as well,
right,
such as whether or not there's many of these fish left or if they're abundant.
Exactly.
I grew up in the Midwest, and so fish to me meant, crappies, sunnies, trout, and walleye.
Okay.
So I've never been much in of a fish eater, but there's many people are in San Diego, and of course fish restaurants are everywhere. So I haven't become I haven't been forced to kind of confront looking at a package of fish and trying to decide whether or not this is something that I should eat. Let's start out by helping people understand when you go to buy fish, and then we'll also talk about the restaurants, but let's just say that you go into your local food market or fish store. How can you use this guide, for example, to help you in making wise choices to keep a sustainable world population of fish?
We've tried to make it as easy for people as we can and let people kind of make use their own criteria as to how much comfort or discomfort they have with the different seafood items. So, for example, if you are going to be very principled about seafood and you don't want to have any shades of gray in terms of, am I doing something that's going to be harmful for the environment in any way, shape, or form, you'd stick with the green best choices list. And it's pretty easy to tell. The seafood counters are responding not just to the work that we're doing through Seafood Watch, but through other institutions and organizations that are part of the broader seafood choices movement. They're now telling you, is this a farmed catfish? Most likely it is if it's in the market in the U.S. Are these shrimp trap caught? Are they U.S. wild caught shrimp? Are they farmed shrimp from somewhere else in the world? Actually, part of the whole homeland security infrastructure that's grown up in the last few years, there's now country of origin labeling on all seafood that you see in the market. So they actually have to declare, was this caught in, the United States, or does this come from Ecuador or from Thailand or from Vietnam or where it may be. So those are things that will help. The other way you can use it, and you're probably less likely to have some of that declarative information if you go to a restaurant, is simply use the pocket guide as a way of asking questions of the server when they come to your table. Mm-hmm. So if you say, is this salmon wild-caught or farmed, and they can't answer that for you, then knowing that farmed salmon is on the avoid list, the red list, and the wild-caught is on the green, if they can't answer it for you, you just say, all right, I'm going to make another choice tonight. And you've put that server and that restaurant on notice that they need to be more aware of what their consumers want if they want to keep you as a customer or keep selling that particular item that's on their menu.
This is interesting because when we look at the guide here, for example, salmon is listed in both the best choices and the avoid. And it's
and
kind of
good alternatives,
and kind of counterintuitive, in some respects. In other words, we'll get into some of the details here without getting too deep. But for example, I think it's informative to know the thinking behind this. For example, the wild caught from Alaska is considered a best choice, and then of course the farmed salmon, including Atlantic salmon, is considered a fish to avoid. One would think it would be the other way around. What's the story here?
One of the main criteria that we look at with wild-caught fish is there a good management system in place? In other words, are there quotas and timing and regulation of the fishing gear such that you're not taking too many fish, you're not taking them in a way that is destructive of other animals or of the habitat and ecosystems that sea creatures depend upon? And Alaska's wild-caught salmon is a best choice because it is among the most tightly regulated fisheries. It's done with hook and line, so you're not catching a lot of other animals, the bycatch that you don't want. It's not done with trawl gear or nets that are damaging or plowing the seafloor. So it's very clean fishery, and manage in such a way that the people who make a living catching fish are going to be able to do that for a long, long time. If you look at farmed salmon, the challenge there is that, by and large, they're densely concentrated, almost feedlot situations in relatively calm coastal water areas. So you have the problems associated with any dense concentration of wildlife or people in a small area. The wastes that they excrete are not necessarily flushed out by the waters very quickly, so you've got a local pollution problem. Because you're having the animals live more densely than they would in the wild, you have to use antibiotics or other drugs to control pests and disease, and that can then spread into the surrounding waters and ecosystem. The farmed salmon are often infested to one degree or another with sea lice, or that becomes a risk. And wild salmon in those same waters, in some cases where you're farming, can become infected with those lice as they swim past these farms. You also have issues of the possibility of those farmed salmon, genetic Atlantic salmon, escaping into the wild through, you know, storm or other damage to the net pans that are holding them, and suddenly they're out in the wild competing with wild stock, some of which are in trouble because of our mismanagement of forests and the construction of dams on their spawning rivers. So now they have another source of competition, and even the possibility that those genetic Atlantic salmon might start to interbreed with their wild Pacific stocks. So there are a variety of issues there. We're always hoping that someone will, within the salmon farming industry, will begin to develop standards and come up with a set of protocols for an acceptable and a clean salmon farming operation. But for the time being, there's no easy way for the consumer going into Costco or whatever supermarket that they shop at to say that, oh yeah, this farmed salmon was good versus that from another label that's not good. So we just say avoid it, stick with wild-caught salmon, enjoy it as a seasonal delicacy. It's phenomenal when it's fresh, and let it go the rest of the time and make another choice.
There's a lot that goes into making wise choices. When you return, you get up to date on making the right choices for yourself, for the oceans, and our world when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith. Coming up, we feature cod, shrimp, oysters, herring, halibut, orange roughy, scallops, shark, and red snapper, and more. Sound good? Sure. Good choices? You may be surprised. We learn how to use the Seafood Watch National Seafood Guide and how you can get yours absolutely free. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. We continue our discussion of Monterey Bay's Seafood Watch Guide with Ken Peterson and how you can know what fish to eat or what fish not to eat.
Of course, this really helps people to force the answers from those people who make their living selling fish, either in restaurants or other sources, you know, to become aware.
That's it. Well, and the other direction that we've grown in over the last few years, we started out, and a lot of other folks in the Seafood Choices movement did as well, working from the ground up, where you put these pocket guides in the hands of individual consumers, arm them with information, send them into the marketplace, and say, hey, here, now you have what you need to know to make good choices. We also realize that it's probably more effective if you can actually convince the supermarket, the restaurant, the food service provider to change their practices so that they are no longer offering to their customers any of the avoid list items. And we've been having a lot of success in that direction, not just us, but the broader movement. And I'll mention a couple that are like huge scale and maybe kind of surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Just within the last month or so, Walmart, which is not necessarily the greatest corporate citizen on a lot of fronts, announced that within 3 years it will only be carrying sustainable seafood in all of its U.S. stores. Compass Group North America, which is the single largest food service company in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, made a similar announcement just a week ago. They are only going to be carrying sustainable seafoods within the next few years as they transition there. These are big, big announcements because Compass Group has food service operations in places like the Getty Center in Los Angeles, the aquarium here in Monterey, where they've already and long been deeply committed to sustainable seafood. They are at corporate headquarters and all kinds of other places. So people who are going to be eating in those facilities will not even have to think about the seafood, and they will probably be trumpeting the fact that they're going sustainable with their seafood choices.
Now, I know, for example, in forestry products, you have the FSC, the Forest Stewardship
Council. I believe it is. There's a Marine Stewardship Council for seafood that's kind of the gold standard, and you can actually see the MSC label.
Are we seeing that very, very often these days on store-bought fish?
More so. Places, some of the, more organic type grocers, whether it's the big ones like the Whole Foods of the world or the smaller regional ones, are buying more Marine Stewardship Council certified seafood. That list of certified species and fish items is growing over time.
That will grow, and we'll see this more often. That'll be a terrific advantage to wise buying.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And we're also using these gatekeepers. I mean, we do an event here at the aquarium every year in May called Cooking for Solutions that brings in some of the top chefs in the country, well-known folks like Jack Pepin or Alice Waters or Martin Yan, who are committed to sustainability themselves, and they are preparing gourmet meals and public events here at the aquarium that are showing folks that you can eat incredible, delicious, fresh, sustainable seafood, organic gourmet dishes for the produce, sustainably grown wines, and it's not a sacrifice, it is in fact better than the things that you would get if you were buying conventional produce, conventional wine, and not paying attention to where your seafood comes from. And the restaurants are moving strongly to become leaders in changing the eating habits of their customers. There's a whole group called the Chefs Collaborative that has chefs nationwide that are changing, and that's kind of the white tablecloth restaurant, but then you get these big food service companies and others who are also changing. So the consumer, if we're fortunate a few years down the road, won't have to be asking as many questions because the questions will have been asked and answered by their providers, whether it's the market or the restaurant. And you can just go there with confidence, and they'll declare we're only selling sustainable seafood, the way you'll find some restaurants and some stores saying this is organic or this is locally grown and in season and fresh.
And with all the bad news about the oceans, this is the good side, is the fact that these types of changes are being implemented in very mainstream corporations. We're becoming aware of our choices, and it's spreading into the general public.
And even the business has become very passionate about it. We have a company here who does a food service for the aquarium called Bon Appetit Management Company, not affiliated with the magazine Bon Appetit. They're headquartered in the Bay Area. And they, when we looked at our own seafood menu and said, we need to change this because we need to walk the talk about sustainable seafood, they embraced that immediately.
Mm-hmm.
That then went from doing it just here at the aquarium to doing it at the 150 corporate accounts that Bon Appetit Management has around the nation. They took it into even beyond seafood because they understood the importance of the integrity of food production process to the quality of the meals they're presenting and the health of the planet. So it was buy more sustainable, buy more organic, buy more local in the season. They are a subsidiary of this giant company, Compass Group North America,
mm-hmm.
and they, because of their passion, their commitment, and the demonstration that not only does it produce incredibly good-tasting food, but it also benefits their bottom line, was able to help convince the parent company to move it forward. So it ripples throughout, and once you become aware, you can't close your eyes, pretend you don't know any longer, and your passion and conviction can convince others.
There's kind of two interesting sides to this story, too. And certainly the information is coming out that we've known this a long time. Fish is terrific brain food. It has literally been proven to be probably the best tonic for brain maintenance out there. And so there's many people who are choosing to add fish to their diet or increase the consumption at a time when, unfortunately, that's a challenge. There is this good side to eating fish, but then, of course, the other side is the fact that in many cases the fish species are contaminated with all sorts of, I mean, yep. it becomes dangerous.
PCBs, mercury, and what have you, because they're concentrating up the food web things that we're putting into it one way or another. And, in fact, one of the changes that we made in our pocket guide just this year was to partner with Environmental Defense, and based on their research on the health risks from eating too much of particular species, we've added a red asterisk by a number of those species where there is an FDA or an Environmental Protection Agency mercury advisory for women childbearing age and for children, and we'll look at any other contaminants down the road. So we're trying to add layers of information for folks so they can help make not only wise choices for the health of the ocean, but wise choices for the health of themselves and their family.
Exactly right. For example, on the avoid list, I would say probably 70% or so have the red asterisk, which suggests that there's a mercury or other contaminants.
Right.
And so it's a wise choice not only for sustainability of the health of the oceans, but as well our own health.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. We're getting a lot more people, you know, who are fired up about this, and I talked about some of the, you know, the businesses that are changing, but mm-hmm. we've actually, through our program now, trying to activate folks who want to do more than just carry a pocket guide. We actually have a whole group of folks who have signed up as Seafood Watch advocates, and we have a separate web address, seafoodwatch.org, people can log on to. And you can actually sign up to become an activist. You can carry the pocket guide, obviously. But we've also created a whole little kit that people can request from us, where if you go into a restaurant where they're serving sustainable seafood, you can leave a little card that says thank you. And if they're serving something that's on the red list, you can put a little card that says become aware and give them a way to connect with our Seafood Watch program, get more information. We've got a whole training program now for restaurateurs and their staff so that they can answer customer questions so that they can make choices, so they can make substitutions that they've always used, you know, Chilean sea bass. We'll give them some alternative species they can select that are sustainable as opposed to ones that are being strip mined out of the ocean. And then we'll do little email alerts to folks the way a lot of organizations are doing now if there's something they can do to step up for ocean wildlife.
Now, if people want to participate in either becoming an activist or learning more as a restaurateur or mm-hmm. cook, or if they just want to find this guide, how can they do so?
Seafoodwatch.org. It's very simple and straightforward, and it's easy to log on. Lots of information. All of our research reports and every seafood species we have can be found right there, and all the pocket guides that we have everywhere in the country, we have, as I say, we have them for every region of the United States. If, for example, you're going to travel to Hawaii, you can download and print out one of our Hawaii pocket guides before you go, and then you'll have the species that you're going to find only in Hawaii. You probably won't see on the menu other places, so I'm just going to, red snapper from the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, or spearfish, or trevally, things that are not going to turn up on the menu or in the seafood market in San Diego or L.A. or Monterey, but will turn up on the menu if you go to Hawaii to order it.
Right, that's fabulous. Let's have a little fun here. For example, one thing I notice is that cod is on all the lists.
Right.
And so this is a situation where you go in and you say, well, what is the status on cod? The pocket guide itself will resolve that. Give some insight into how this has been determined.
Cod is the traditional, you know, the white fish, the staple of New England and eastern Canada, the Grand Banks. It was the basis for, you know, the economy of a lot of fishing communities for a long, long time. There were even cod wars because it was so valuable. There, you know, you could practically walk on the backs of codfish off the eastern seaboard when people from Europe first came there. What happened was, through mismanagement, that population of fish collapsed in the last 25 years to the point that in eastern Canada there were 30 or 40,000 people thrown out of work because there were no more cod to catch or process. You know, it's an environmental disaster, it's a social and economic disaster for the region, and it has not yet recovered, and there are some fishery scientists who question if cod will ever be able to reoccupy the niche it once had because of changes to the habitat and other creatures moving in and taking their place in the food web. So while there may be some sources that you can find if you go to New England, where there are fishermen who are hook and line catching cod under very restrictive guidelines, and it would be okay to order it there, as a blanket rule, if you see Atlantic cod somewhere, it is not being caught sustainably, or Icelandic cod is the same thing, and we would put that on the red list.
Mm-hmm.
Now, flip side of that, if you look at Pacific cod, which is being caught in Alaska, the very best choice you can make is trap or hook and line caught. Again, you don't have a lot of damage to habitat. You're not taking other species because the cod tend to appear in fairly dense aggregations, dense schools when they're around. And if you know who your supplier is and you can ask them that question, that would be a best choice. Pacific longline or trawl caught cod is a good alternative, but the challenge there is that there are some habitat damage involved with the trawling.
Mm-hmm.
The long lining could wind up catching some other animals, seabirds and other marine animals that are killed and then thrown overboard as bycatch.
Mm-hmm.
So if your tolerance for that level of damage to the environment or other wildlife is a little higher, you might say, okay, if I don't know the source of the specific cod, I'll still order it. But if I'm really feeling, you know, I don't want to be responsible, you know, do no harm at all, then I would ask and say, is this trap or hook and line caught Pacific cod? And that would be the best choice, and you could make that selection there.
Let's say you go into the restaurant and you just want to be safe. What are, let's say, two or three examples of fish that if you order that fish, you're probably going to be all right?
Okay, I would say anytime you get Dungeness crab in season, no problem at all. Anytime you get Pacific halibut, which is a pretty good choice right here in California, certainly. If you get the pink shrimp, the little bay shrimp that you often see in seafood salads, not the bigger ones, but those tiny little ones,
mm-hmm.
that would be always a safe choice. Striped bass, which is a farmed fish by and large, always a safe choice. Rainbow trout, always. Farmed mussels, oysters, always a good choice, as well as farmed clams. And if you get domestic caviar, surprisingly, if you're looking for a treat, of course the beluga caviar from the Caspian is now outlawed for import into the U.S. because the species is so endangered in the Caspian. But farmed caviar is the best choice because it's done in a very sustainable way with white sturgeon. And so you can have yourself a very elegant treat there without feeling at all any guilt about the health of the environment.
All right, let's go to the other extreme.
Well, certainly, anytime you see Chilean sea bass or Patagonian toothfish, that is an absolute avoid. The same thing for orange roughy. In the case of Chilean sea bass, there is some minimal legitimate fishery, but more of it is being caught by fishery pirates who care nothing about the health of the environment or the long-term survival of the population. And it just encourages continued violation of fisheries management. Orange roughy is a very deep water fish, long-lived. There are some of them that could have been alive at the time that Abraham Lincoln was president. And they are basically, when fishermen find them, they go into an area where they're abundant. They catch them until they aren't abundant. And that's because they basically strip-mined the population out of the wild. Farmed salmon is an avoid species, and that's going to be a lot of the salmon you see in most places you go. Imported swordfish, if you get some domestic swordfish, there may be some that are on our good alternatives list. There's still some challenges, but that population's coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, monkfish would be another species to avoid.
This is a fabulously efficient little way to make a difference. This is the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch National Seafood Guide available. Why don't you give us that website again where they can go to get this?
You can go right to seafoodwatch.org. It's just part of the overall aquarium website, and you can get into the rest of the aquarium's website at the same time. But you can get all the information, get any questions asked and answered about why we have our different recommendations. You can download any of our pocket guides, whether it's a national one, a West Coast regional guide, one for Hawaii or any other part of the U.S. you may be traveling to. And it's right there and updated regularly.
And what do you have coming up at the Monterey Bay Aquarium in the months ahead?
Well, we're doing a whole series of events this year called the Year of Exploring, trying to connect kids more and families more deeply with wildlife. We're encouraging explorations. You'll get out there in nature, and we're having special events here every month or so that folks can find out about on our website at montereybayaquarium.org. For those people who want to eat gourmet and sustainably and learn something about what makes for sustainable seafood, we've got a great event coming up in May 19th and 20th called Cooking for Solutions with some incredible chefs from around the country. And it's a gourmet gala on a Friday night, this Cooking for Solutions event. And you can find out about that at cookingforsolutions.org, which is another part of the aquarium's website. And just the usual incredible exhibits. You know, we're considered the number one aquarium in the U.S. and among the top family attractions in the country. Always something new and amazing to see.
Well, if anybody ever needed another reason to go to San Francisco, they just got another one.
There you go. And we're just a couple hours south of San Francisco, and you either drive up the Highway 1 or come down on the way back to Southern California. Take yourself through Big Sur part of the way. It's really a gorgeous part of the world and a place where you can connect very deeply with nature. You can see a lot of the marine life, in particular when you're in the aquarium, and then connect with it and understand it better as you're traveling the coast through the region.
Ken Peterson with the Monterey Bay Aquarium, I want to thank you for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
It's been my pleasure, and thanks for all that you do.
Each of us makes thousands of little choices each day. With billions of people on the planet making trillions of right choices or trillions of wrong choices, every day makes a difference. Choose right, or things can go wrong, as they did 60 years ago, when the freedoms we fought and died for were sequestered in the name of war. Sound familiar? It's Manzanar. What's that mean? You'll find out after this short break, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Nature serves us in so many ways. It gives us the life we have. It inspires our spirits and fills our eyes with wonder. We tread on it, live with it. It nourishes us. We learn to live in balance, or not. In a moment, we will learn another use for nature. Supreme isolation, forced solitude, a place some try to forget, while others remember, when we return on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
In a remote area of California, backdropped by the Sierra Nevada Mountains, with vast panoramic vistas and a valley rich with productive apple orchards, World War II to be specific, made a stand right in the middle of this vast, serene place. Manzanar is a name many would like to forget. But this past weekend, many came to remember. Manzanar is now part of our national park system and their Park of the Week. To tell us more about this historic site is Frank Hayes, superintendent of the Manzanar National Historic Site. It's quite a story and one which has very specific relevance to our world today. Frank, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. And you?
Doing great, thanks.
How's the weather out there?
Well, it's cold and windy. You know, the former internees talk about there always was the wind in this valley And that's usually the case. It's almost always windy. Some part of the day you'll get some gusty winds coming off of the Sierra Nevada or the Inyo Mountains, and definitely a part of life that we deal with out here today.
Well, it's different wherever we go, and that's part of the miraculous nature of nature.
That's correct, Frank.
Give us a picture of Manzanar when a world war changed forever this peaceful valley.
Well, in 1942, February 19th, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which put into motion the evacuation or removal or of Japanese Americans from what were called exclusion zones from the west coast of Washington, Oregon, and California to inland, one of 10 inland war relocation centers. Manzanar was one of those war relocation centers. It was opened in April of 1942, and its depopulation, there was over 10,000 Japanese Americans interned in the camp within less than a square mile, about 550 acres. And the war relocation center was made up of 36 blocks, each block having 14 tar paper barracks, a mess hall, a latrine, two latrine buildings, a men's and a woman's latrine building, and then some utility rooms. And each apartment barrack was split up into four separate apartments. The barracks were 20 foot by 100 feet long, and so each apartment was 20 by 25 feet. And right at the beginning when the camp was opened, up to eight people occupied each of the four apartments within the barracks, and it could have been eight people from a single family or from different families, so it was definitely something, you know, privacy issues and so forth that people were having to deal with right when they first moved into camp.
I'm just curious, to what degree were people able to bring in their personal belongings?
They were allowed two trunkfuls, basically, of their personal belongings, so, you know, there was 120,000 Japanese Americans impacted by the internment, and most of them either sold their belongings at cut-rate prices or, you know, lost them during the war. There were some that had friends or churches that stepped up and took care of their belongings, their homes or their farms while the Japanese Americans were interned, but the vast majority lost most of everything, and so, like I said, they could bring two trunks, essentially per person, into camp of their belongings. And, you know, it was hard for folks to know what to bring because they didn't know what to expect. You know, many of them were leaving kind of moderate, temperate climates or pretty harsh environments at one of the 10 camps. And so it was, you know, it was hard for them to pack and decide what to carry. And they didn't know how long they were going for or, you know, what kind of conditions they were going to face. So
I suppose the furniture was pretty much standard issue throughout the site.
Pardon?
I suppose that the furniture was this kind of standard issue throughout the...
Yeah, it was actually pretty Spartan, and in fact, you know, a lot of the folks, and one of the most compelling pieces, I think, in our exhibits are some beautiful pieces of furniture, dresser drawers, that were made out of fruit crates from one of the camps. So, you know, the internees were gathering up spare wood, thrown away wood, wherever they could, and were fashioning furniture out of that spare parts wherever they could. And some of it, you know, it's just, this furniture we have on display is just absolutely beautiful. It's created out of fruit crates.
Very interesting. By the way, people can see elements of the site as well as a map on the website. Well, you can click on that, and it will enlarge. So how long were people there?
They were up here for up to 3 years. In February 1943, the government, realizing some of the constitutional issues that they were facing and so forth, opened up the camps for people to relocate out of into the outside of the exclusion zone, so they had to have a job and guarantee that there weren't going to be any problems, and then have somebody sponsor them in the interior. Now, there were some people who had contacts and were able to do that, but quite a number were in camp for the entire 3 years. They closed finally in November of 1945.
Now, by the way, is it proper to refer to internment and relocation kind of in the same breath?
Well, you know, that's a terminology of how you describe the camps is something we, I don't say we would struggle with, but we definitely thought carefully about and dialogued with a variety of people and thought the best approach was to explain the wide breadth of terminology that's being used to describe the war relocation centers. We generally rely on the historic names, but we show and interpret the sites for everything they were called. Some folks here in the valley and other places refer to them as, you know, historically as Jap camp, and then it's all the way through to being called concentration camps. President Roosevelt called them concentration camps, and many in the Japanese American community prefer that they're called concentration camps today.
Well,
we try to interpret that breadth of terminology and then allow visitors, invite visitors to figure out, you know, what that particular visitor thinks about the terminology and what happened out at the 10 camps.
So the camp was eventually over, and then what happened, and that relates to the question of what's there now today. So tell us that little story.
Well, Manzanar was located on City of Los Angeles land. The City of L.A. has brought up much of the Owens Valley to preserve water rights. They export a lot of the Owens Valley water that comes out of Sierra Nevada down to Los Angeles. And so much of the valley floor is owned by Los Angeles, and the site where Manzanar is located was, during the war, World War II, owned by Los Angeles, and up until 1997, when the site was transferred to the Park Service, was still owned by the City of Los Angeles. And so it had pretty much remained untouched. Now, all the buildings, there were 850 buildings that were used during the years the War Relocation Center was open, and all but three of those buildings were removed. But there's still ample evidence of the camps, the road networks, the foundations, these incredibly beautiful rock gardens that the Japanese Americans constructed while they were here are present throughout the site, and those are all readily visible. And there's also a kind of an iconic cemetery monument out on the west side of the site that you know, there was an actual working cemetery, and there's actually still folks interred there.
Now, just recently, you had your grand opening for the Interpretive Center, and that's kind of an interesting story right there in terms of where the Interpretive Center is. It's giant. Tell us about that. We've got about a minute and a half left, so we'll move on rather quickly.
Okay, great. Well, the Interpretive Center was an auditorium building constructed by the internees in 1944. That building was occupied by the Inyo County for 50 years or more as their maintenance facility. The Park Service acquired that building and adaptively restored it into our interpretive center. So now we have 8,000 square feet of exhibits about the internment camps. We have two small movie theaters that show the 20-minute film we've produced about the internment. We've got a ranger information desk, a bookstore, and then our headquarters offices are all located right there in this interpretive center. So that's one of the three buildings that had remained from the camp period.
It looks like actually an interesting place, although I'm sure it has many mixed memories. Let's do two things. Let's tell people how they can go to your site literally and virtually.
All right, great. Well, we'll start out virtually. Go to NPS, like NationalParkService.gov, /MANZ, M-A-N-Z, and make sure you click on the in-depth section because there's many illustrations of the camp and exhibits and so forth, much more in-depth information than you find on many other National Park web pages. We're quite proud of it. And then to visit the site personally, we're open 8:35 daily, Monday through Sunday, so 7 days a week, except for Christmas. And you can reach it by driving 4 hours north of Los Angeles on Highway 395. We're between the small communities of Lone Pine, California, and Independence, California, near the shadows of Mount Whitney.
Frank, thanks for being with us. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again on the Wild Side News.